everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LaPage.
She's back!
Woo! Yay!
She survived the one election. Can she survive two? We'll see this fall. You're not going to be involved, but... I felt like a very cliffhangery movie thing to say. That might be like in a superhero movie like The Incredibles, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Cool. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new superhero family adventure, The Incredibles 2. That is in the back half of the show, and for the first half, we're going to talk about some of the news items from the past week, including business news. Didn't see that coming.
How exciting.
I know. AT&T will be allowed to buy Time Warner, and Comcast is trying to buy 21st Century Fox out from under Disney. But the real cost of these mergers, though. And then there's a couple of interesting trailers released this last week, including the story about a nun, story about a Grinch, and an elephant with big ears. And we'll talk about those. And then Samuel L. Jackson was asked to rank the top 20 roles of his career, and we'll decide whether he was right or not. But first of all... because this has become an ongoing theme of the show, Me Too claims another one, and maybe it shows again just how pervasive harassment and assault is in the movie nerd news business. I mean, because that's the kind of, you know, there's been all the Hollywood stuff, so you got your Weinsteins and your Spaceys and even your Morgan Freemans that got accusations, but I mean, there's been an equally big belch in this in terms of nerd movie coverage. So you had your Devin Faracis, your Harry Knowles, there was the guy who started Honest Trailers whose name escapes me.
Oh really? I must have missed that one.
Yeah. And now we have Chris Hardwick, or at least we assume it's Chris Hardwick. I mean, he's
I read the Medium piece. It's definitely Chris Hardwick.
Yeah. The young woman's name is Chloe Dykstra. She's a writer in her own right, an internet personality. She did, what is that show? Heroes of Cosplay or Lords of Cosplay?
Yeah, something like that. I think it was Heroes of Cosplay.
Yeah, yeah, because that, yeah, Lords kind of genderifies that. But yeah, so she posted this piece on Medium talking about her three-year relationship with a guy who went from a podcaster to his own nerd empire, and a man who was 20 years her senior, and people...
Recovering alcoholic. I mean, all signs point
people to... People read those tea leaves to mean Chris Hardwick, who people may be familiar with. He does The Talking Dead after The Walking Dead show. He did At Midnight. He has another game show on NBC, I think.
Oh, yeah, The Big Wall. Plinko. The giant Plinko game.
Yeah, the Plinko ripoff. he does stand-up.
I can't believe I knew that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm just going to apologize to everybody.
Nerd test. But yeah, so the people read the tea leaves fairly quickly, and the Nerdist, which was the site he founded, the podcast he founded, erased him from the face of the website with alarming speed. Although, as we're recording this, we're still waiting to hear from AMC because he had a talk show that was supposed to be coming back this week.
Yeah.
But your thoughts on this, because I'm the guy, you're the girl.
Yeah.
Give us thoughts, girl.
So I am a regular listener of what was the Nerdist podcast and is now Idiot spelt funny. With a one in it, I-D-1-O-T.
It's like noob with zeros.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. So I was a regular listener of this podcast. And so the thing with listening to podcasts, listening to shows that are kind of about the host, even when they're actually interview shows like The Nerdist, is that you get to know the host quite well. So as I started to read this Medium piece, I was not particularly surprised. You know, she starts off by talking about some of the controlling behaviors that he had. And I said, I can totally see all of those. And a lot of the reason why I listened to the podcast is because a lot of it was really about him as well and learning his faults and working through them. And while there wasn't a lot of talk about his breakup with Chloe Dykstra on the show, she was on the show, you know, every once in a while in, in the openings, and then suddenly she just wasn't there anymore, and then pretty quickly his new girlfriend was there, and now they're married. And so I certainly, you know, followed this whole, like, oh, I guess she just sort of disappeared, and oh, we've got someone new. And and so a lot of, I mean, he's a jerk. I mean, I can safely say that he's a jerk.
Yeah.
I don't think that comes as a surprise to anybody. I don't think it even comes as a surprise to Chris Hardwick. Mm. He knows that he's a bit of a cocky jerk. And,
yeah.
You know, much like Dan Harmon, I hope that he takes this as a way to go, okay, I need to fix some things.
Right.
Whether or not Dan Harmon has actually done a good job of fixing things either. I mean, and I have talked about this in the past, right? We talked about the John Lasseter thing.
Yeah.
And how these are opportunities for men to truly understand their actions.
Right.
And I do believe that they can understand them, compensate for it somehow, you know, like, that they can do something. I do want to believe in restorative justice.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. This is it's a hard one. I mean, they're all hard ones, really. Yeah. It is sort of a thing where, similarly, you already talked about how it seems to be a little rampant in celebrity and nerddom and all that sort of stuff. And that doesn't surprise me either for two reasons. One is because it's kind of rampant, period.
Yes.
And so this is, these are places where there are a lot of eyes. So it's easier for women now to come forward because they feel they have more strength now because more and more women are doing it. So it's...
In so much as it's ever easy.
Yeah. So it's certainly going to sort of explode in this more public way and hopefully bleed over to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But I also think that that is an industry. And I know a lot of artists. I know a lot of people who have... You know, musicians and actors and all that sort of stuff who have sort of gone near that world or gone into a much smaller version of that world in Canada, and it's a place that becomes really easy for your flaws to be the parts of you that you get to flaunt and you get to do more of.
Sure.
And it's not a nice world out there in the industry, as they say.
Right. I don't think that's ever been a secret, or if it's been a secret, it's been an open secret. I mean, if you look at all the people who get involved in drugs and alcohol, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's about feeding parts of themselves that they may not necessarily enjoy because that's the part of themselves that they need to tap into to be successful. And, you know, perhaps Chris Hardwick was the same way, and it was in his interest to be this jerk. To put it lightly.
To put it in the obvious sense.
But, I mean, to go with what you said about restorative justice, you know, he really put out a release, I think it was late last night our time. It was still kind of late, you know, mm-hmm. California time, it was because it was like 9 p.m. in California. But where he's, you know, basically slut shames her. It's just like, oh, yeah, she cheated on me and then I dumped her and then she tried to get me back.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? If you were even a little bit innocent, I can't. And you had a even remotely competent message control, you probably might have left out that last paragraph mm-hmm. about cheating and she begged me to take her back and et cetera. That's not good.
No.
You should have ended at the first paragraph and, like, you know, if she, you know, I feel sorry if she feels like I mistreated her. But, yeah, it's just, it's hard to, I guess, turn off that tap. Even if there are details in the letter she wrote that are perhaps, you know, that she either misremembers or sees in a bit more harsher light. And, mm-hmm. of course, we also want to believe victims. And it's kind of sad that, you know, seeing... people come up with, like, well, do you have any evidence he did? So it's like, of course. Like, she was collecting samples the whole time. Come on.
Yeah.
It's, you know, people conflate the law and order stuff with, like, the real life stuff. And, you know, there's a reason why we've sort of gotten this far. It's because, mm-hmm. you know, hard evidence.
Yeah. And finger quotes. The problem is that the human brain with any sort of traumatic experience changes things. We misremember all the time. You know, we either... you know, forgive a number of things that are traumatic and try to, you know, our brain tells us that it was our fault.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it goes the other way and we remember it even more harshly because we're so deeply hurt by it.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately...
And there's also, like, this where, you know, people are, like, you know, tweeting at her and, like, well, how could you have stayed with her? How could you have been so stupid? And it's like, well, that's reinforcing a behavior too, because I'm sure she's asking herself, like, how could I have put up with this for 3 years? And I think that was also fairly implied in her letter on Medium. It's like, I have no idea why.
Why? Because she was only a 22-year-old girl. That's why.
Like, well, there's that too, yeah.
I mean, this, like, yeah, it's one of those things where I hope that if I see some of my friends, whether it's men or women, who are dating someone who seems dramatically younger than them, that we talk about it. You know, just tell me more about this. Tell me what kind of person this is and how, you know, how, like, because it doesn't matter that they're both adults according to the law.
Right.
Like,
well,
it also doesn't matter that Chris Hardwick is just a giant man-child.
There's that, too. Although, I guess he sleeps freeze-dried because he's holding up pretty well at 47. but, you know, you're right about that, because there was the thing about in Montreal, I think it was at Concordia, the literature program there, about a number of women who were in the master's program there felt like they're being preyed upon by older male professors, which again is not necessarily rape or necessarily statutory rape, but you know, there is a difference between what a 40-something-year-old man knows and what a 20-something-year-old young woman knows.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of a microcosm of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Candace, I'm so glad you're here so we can have a good conversation. So it's not just an awkward conversation with me and Vince when this stuff comes up, because it seems to be it's either you or Vince that this the weeks these occur on. So I'm glad you're back. We do have to move on to the business news I mentioned earlier, that we have it was weird these two things kind of coalesced in the same week, where we had AT&T buying Time Warner. That was approved by a federal judge, and I'll get to that in a sec. But now Comcast wants to buy 21st Century Fox, which, if people remember back before, I think it was before Christmas, that Disney had signed the deal, and everyone was really excited because that means X-Men get to be in the MCU.
Yeah.
Without really kind of understanding that Disney owns like 90% of everything now, and you know, maybe that's not such a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So,
nor is it good for Comcast to own 90%
of
everything.
I know, really.
You know?
Like, I don't want to sound like a free market capitalist right now, but can we get fewer privately owned monopolies? Like, I'm very concerned about this, and I'm really surprised that the AT&T Time Warner merger happened. And I know I was on the show the week the Fox and Disney deal was struck, and we were talking about this then, saying, like, is this even going to be allowed? Like, this feels really dangerous.
Yeah.
Technically, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it could be even dangerous in an actual, like, you know, people will have no opportunity to work if they're, for instance, as Chloe Dykstra was blacklisted from the, you know, production companies that she was working with, right? If you have this just giant monopoly of entertainment.
Or there's only so many places you can go, because, I mean, there were 6 major studios in Hollywood, and now you're looking at there being 5.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no matter how this turns out, there will be 5. There will be, you know, Disney, Comcast, Warner's, Sony, and I'm forgetting one.
Paramount is owned by
Paramount
Sony, right?
Paramount is, yeah. No, well, I think they're, no, Paramount is owned by CBS.
CBS, okay.
But, yeah, so there's only 5. You know, if you want to make a movie in Hollywood, you know, there are only so many places you can go. To go where you said about, you know, it's weird that, you know, we're concentrating so much. The judge in the AT&T Time Warner case, I was reading a Verge article that sort of broke down his decision. And what it sounds like is, in similar way that when Mark Zuckerberg was talking to Congress a couple of months ago, we have a bunch of old people who really don't know how media works and are making these big decisions, because the judge put no conditions on the merger at all. He's just like, yeah, that seems good. Like, he even understood that HBO Go and Netflix were like similar services.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't really understand like the auspices of like net neutrality, what
that
means.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, this opens up the door again to cell providers and internet providers saying, well, you can only use this program.
Right.
That's the one.
Yeah. Like, you can only access,
yeah,
you know, something like, you know, HBO Go, which is owned by Time Warner, you know, but, you know, you may have to pay a premium if you want to access Hulu or Amazon Prime or any of these other sites. It's dangerous. And it seems like we have people making decisions about this stuff who don't understand, you know, whether it's judges, whether it's Congress people. And, you know, that's not good. I mean, it's always been hard. The technology's always been so far out front. But, you know, going back to the days of, you know, when TV started to become a commercial medium, you know, there were people who shrewdly made the decision then that you know, TV companies would get the airwaves for free if they would provide, you know, educational services and informational services, which became the nightly news. Yeah. But this is, nobody seems to be understanding what the implications of this are and aren't laying out any you know, preconditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big one that got the attention of the AT&T Time Warner thing was, of course, CNN, because Cheeto Mussolini in the White House has a beef with CNN.
Is that what we're calling him now? Okay.
Well, I have a couple of nicknames I run through, but he has a beef with CNN. So it was wondered, like, what's, you know, separating CNN out from this huge conglomerate precondition? And it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then that goes back into the net neutrality thing, because say you want to watch MSNBC on your computer. Nope, you got to watch CNN. You can get CNN for free, but you have to pay for MSNBC, which gets back into the whole mishigas with how things were packaged on cable, which has been the bane of people's existence for 20 years, and why they're cord cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're in a lot of agreement here.
Yeah, it's a real circular conversation we're having here. Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it's worth noting, because, you know,
because we can say I told you so.
Sure. That sounds fine.
Right. 7 years from now, we'll go, remember we called it.
Yeah. Looking back at end credits episode number 50. No, it's that would be kind of funny, especially in that voice. But yeah, it's so myopic, because speaking of the nerd news angle, the folks is always going, what is this going to mean for your favorite franchises? Screw your favorite franchises. What's it going to mean for if you want to watch something on a network that isn't owned by your internet provider?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What's the free speech implications of that? I don't care if the X-Men ever team up the Avengers. I mean, a little bit, but it's, you know, it doesn't matter as much to me as, like, as someone who owns an online publishing platform, some being able to choose to read my site, but they can't because their internet provider has blocked me because I'm not owned by such and such conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that would really happen to me. I'm a small fish. But
it's just like we're heading for North Korea, except it's not the government that owns everything. It's some private businesses.
Yeah, Continuum's becoming real.
Mm.
It's a great show, but I wouldn't want to live in that future.
Yeah.
let's talk about trailers.
Sure thing.
Oh, well, thank you for the enthusiasm. So there were like three kind of biggish trailers. One was for Dumbo, which is from Tim Burton, and it's a remake of the Disney movie Dumbo. I'm very lukewarm about this, even though I've been a huge Tim Burton fan for many years.
I have the opposite, because I am not a Tim Burton fan. I'm just like, Tim, can you just, like, turn down the Burton, please?
Just turn down the Burton.
Turn the volume way down on that. So as it started, I was like, ugh. Really? We're making Dumbo again? What was wrong with the original cartoon? Then I was like, okay, well, it's live action. I don't understand.
Racist crows.
Okay, you're right. That is wrong. but I'm like, okay, it's live action, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And then it was like, from Tim Burton. I was like, oh, God. But as I watched the rest of the trailer, I was like, oh, this might be Tim Burton turned down. This might be more Big Fish, less everything else he's done.
I got a Big Fishy vibe because, you know, it takes place at the circus and Danny DeVito is there.
Yeah.
I also forgot Michael Keaton is in this, and it's the first time they've teamed up, I think, since Batman Returns.
Yeah.
So that's kind of exciting because I think Tim Burton gets Michael Keaton's crazy side in a way that other, I mean, not that Michael Keaton's had much opportunity to release that. He's become like a very kind of serious Oscar, like he's in the Oscar stuff. You hire Michael Keaton, it's Oscar time.
Yeah.
So I like the idea it's tapping into that, and I think Eva Green is like, you know, if she had been, you know, famous 20 years ago, she would be like the Winona Ryder role in Edward Scissorhands, because she's just got that look, and
yeah,
she's got that crazy eyes look that is really engaging. And she has not been... she's been fine in the Tim Burton movies, but she's not been in good Tim Burton movies.
Yeah.
She was great in Dark Shadows as the crazy evil witch. And then she was okay as Miss Peregrine. And I mean, that book has problems too. But
these are just things I just haven't even watched because I just can't. I just can't. Like,
but yeah, I do have kind of a hope because there was like a weird kind of Spielbergian vibe because there's like the family in it. And that Colin Farrell is the dad and they find Dumbo and there's lots of hugging Dumbo. And
yeah.
Which is cute. Not really Tim Burton's wheelhouse, but you know, you might be right. You might tone it down a little. You're probably looking forward to The Nun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I was like, oh, this is great. There. Okay. So I feel like probably one of my favorite genres of horror is the like Catholic mysticism stuff.
Yeah.
I love the devil possessing people,
yeah.
Exorcisms, you know, all that sort of stuff. Stigmata, you know, it just...
Stigmata is a garbage movie, but it's
absolutely.
A lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely, it's garbage. They're all garbage. Maybe not all. Sorry, some of them are good. But I just, that's like...
Exorcist is okay.
Yeah. So as soon as I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be fun. And it definitely looks fun, and I couldn't tell you what the heck happens in the movie. I'm like, no. I think we got zero plot. I have no idea.
I think there's a creepy nun in it.
It's a creepy nun. There's a young nun.
There's a young nun, and it's Tessa Farmiga, who is Vera Farmiga's younger sister. And Vera Farmiga, of course, is one of the main characters in the Conjuring movies proper, not in the Conjuring expanded universe. But she's
Elaine Warner.
Elaine
isn't
Warren,
she?
Yeah. So I mean, that's that has to be a purposeful bit of casting to hire the little sister.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's all the before The Conjuring and before Annabelle. I also, do you know what? The Conjuring was really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that any of the films that have been made sort of in that universe since then have been as good or any better. But I still sort of hold hope that...
I like Conjuring 2. It's not as good as the first Conjuring, but I think it holds up. And I thought Annabelle Creation was decent.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, certainly decent.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And the young actress in Annabelle Creation, who's the possessed girl, I thought was really good. And, yeah. And the first Annabelle movie, though, is garbage.
Mm-hmm.
It's, with, you know, like evil hippies and Manson, it's also very Rosemary's Baby in places, which, there's like too many things going on in that movie before you even get to Annabelle. I'm looking forward
to it. Sort of Exorcist style vibe to this, with it being all
Damien Bashir's in it too as a priest. And yeah, at the beginning of the trailer, it says like, watch to the very end of the trailer, and I rolled my eyes at that. And I did watch to the very end, and it got me at the end where the faceless nun is like falling behind her, and then the other like nun comes out of nowhere. And I was like, okay, well done, Conjuring trailer.
Well, and because so The Exorcist 3 has this great scene that is forever for me the scariest scene I've ever seen in a horror movie, and it's a jump scare, but it just works so well of this like. Nun walking down a hall and suddenly like someone comes after her from the other side. And so I was so like reminiscent of that, waiting for it. And so it happened. I was like, oh,
somebody did their scary nun homework.
Yeah.
And that brings us to The Grinch, which
I'm glad to hear your enthusiasm.
I don't need it. It was like, I thought the beginning where it was kind of like the vaguely Danny Elfman like score. And then when he's in bed and then the alarm clock goes off and it's playing Happy, which is from the Despicable Me movies. And he kind of like bashes his clock, and I was like, oh, maybe this will be different. But then it's like him like just being a dick at the grocery store. And it's like, well, that was kind of what Jim Carrey did and for the first 90 minutes of the live action Grinch. Although, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is the voice of the Grinch.
Mm-hmm. I did enjoy the...
So I mean, if they give him something even remotely interesting to do, I don't know. But
I mean, I won't see it. I can say that right now. I haven't seen a Grinch film in a while. I was never a fan of the original 60s.
What?
It just didn't do it for me. I'm a Charlie Brown Christmas kind of gal.
Fair enough. I didn't know that those were tribes, but okay.
It is, and I am.
I didn't realize Christmas specials from the 60s were tribal.
Yep.
But there you go.
Everything is a tribe.
So that brings us to Samuel L. Jackson. The website Undefeated asked him to choose his top 20 roles of all time. And there were like some surprising choices. up to and including number 12, which was his bad guy role from Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, which I did not remember at all.
Yeah, there were a number of films there that I was like, oh, I've seen Samuel L. Jackson in a billion movies, and apparently I've still missed some.
He has 178 credits.
Good Lord.
178 acting credits on IMDb. Yeah. So he is a prolific mofo.
Yeah. So I was very glad to see that his role from The Red Violin was on there.
Yeah, so was I, because it's one of his quieter parts.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that film, and I was just like, oh, that is so nice that he appreciates, I mean, only at 19, but... of 178 or whatever number you just said. That's all right.
It did surprise me. Maybe it shouldn't surprise me. He has Mace Windu at number 3, which I understand his line to that was like, I got to play a Jedi. And it's like, yeah, I get that. Yeah. But Mace Windu, like, there was no part.
There was nothing. Yeah. I can definitely understand why it's in the top 5 because, you know, he's right. Like, come on. I get to be in Star. It's the same thing with Ewan McGregor, I think, right? Like, why would you take this role? Because I get to play a Jedi. Like, what don't you understand about this?
Yeah, I just wish they could have given him something else to do in that role other than just be always on, like, and I don't trust that kid. I mean, even if it was like Sam Jackson style, just like, I don't know.
Yeah. I sort of feel the same way, though, about him saying Nick Fury. I'm like,
yeah, that's kind of pro
forma. He's not really doing a lot in those movies.
He's exposition.
Yeah.
He's exposition, man. I was interested to see Long Kiss Goodnight as his number one.
Yeah.
As Mitch Hennessy.
Not seen that movie.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful?
It is awful.
I've also never watched Jungle Fever.
No, I haven't seen Jungle Fever either, but I'm not a big Spike Lee fan.
Yeah, I kind of was in the 90s, so I don't know why I didn't see it. I think because I was still very young, and it was a lot of race relations to watch, and I think that maybe it was just too much for me at the time, but I should definitely revisit it.
Yeah, but Mitchell Hennessy, I mean, that was, I think, I don't know if, Shane Black didn't direct it, but he did write it. It was like his attempt at comeback after being out of Hollywood for a while. And then, but I mean, it's such a Shane Black movie. That it's, you know, if you like, you know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys, it's definitely worth checking out The Last Kiss Goodnight. Great Gina Davis role, too. She's really awesome in that. I mean, before, you know, we have a bunch of butt-kicking women on TV and in the movies now. But, I mean, this was like a couple of years before that. So she really set the stage. And it's a very underappreciated movie, even though I think a lot of people, more people appreciate it now than when it came out in 96, I think. But he's got a lot of interesting choices. He had Valentine from Kingsman when he played Shaft in the Shaft remake.
Yes.
I have a soft spot for that movie because I did enjoy that. Jeffrey Wright is such an awesome villain in that movie. He's just so over the top. It's delightful. He's delightful in that. And then A Time to Kill, you know, is probably the most famous Sam Jackson line ever delivered in film, except for maybe the Bible quoting scene in Pulp Fiction.
And not Snakes on a Plane?
I'm surprised Snakes on the Plane wasn't. I'm surprised it just wasn't like number 20 or something, because it was a movie built around Sam Jackson getting up in the middle of a plane and saying, I've had enough of these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane, which is, of course, the sanitized version of that. But I mean, it was the whole idea of the movie was built around that scene.
Yep.
And, you know, it's kind of like a star vehicle for him, but to each his own. So we leave that there and take a break and talk about another Samuel Jackson vehicle, which is The Incredibles 2. And before that, we're going to play a little Adrian Teacher and the Subs. And this is Victory Square from their latest album, Terminal City. Some compelling themes there, I think, for cueing us into The Incredibles. Maybe. I don't know. You be the judge. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, well, campus and community radio. Stop, that's not matter. How could you do that to me, baby? How could you?
What is the main reason you were all forced underground?
Ignorance.
Perception. Take today, for example, with the Underminer. Difficult situation. You were faced with a lot of hard decisions.
Oh, tell me about it.
I can't. Because I didn't see it. Neither did anyone else. So, when you fight bad guys like today, people don't see the fight or what led up to it. They see what politicians tell them to see. They see destruction, and they see you. So, if we want to change people's perceptions about superheroes, we need you to share your perceptions with the world.
How do we do that?
With cameras.
We need you to share your perceptions with the world.
How do we do that?
We embed tiny cameras like those into your super suits.
Wow, so small. And the picture is outstanding.
Thanks. Designed them myself.
And that was a clip from The Incredibles 2. It's the new film from Pixar and writer-director Brad Bird, and stars the voice talents of Craig T. Nelson, Holly Hunter, Sarah Vowell, Huck Milner, Catherine Keener, Bob Odenkirk, and Samuel L. Jackson, who you may know from other films that we just talked about. not a lot for Frozone to do in this movie, but this was a pretty good sequel. This was a pretty good follow-up. I feel like I have, like if we were to wait this long for an incredible sequel, what, almost 15 years?
Yeah.
I'm glad we got this.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was, I was a little worried when I saw it was 2 hours long.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel it at all. Like,
no.
It felt super well-paced throughout the whole film. So, yeah. I mean,
it balanced really well the home stuff, and the, you know, I think a lot of it is because character motivations are put first and not, you know, what can we do in terms of big action sequences, and there are a lot of those. But the home stuff never felt like a lull.
No.
It always felt like there was something funny or interesting going on. And even when I worried it was going to get too silly, like there's a scene where Jack fights a raccoon. And I was just like,
that was just about the silliest it got, though. Like,
that was, I mean, that was a silly, but I mean, in different hands, that would have been unbearable to watch.
Yeah.
To watch the superpowered baby fight a raccoon for, I think, like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was quite a long scene, but it was basically the, you know, Jack learning all of his powers.
Right. And that's, I mean,
we had to go through like 9 seasons of Smallville to learn all of Clark Kent's powers. Maybe it was 12. I don't remember.
I mean, yeah, he would get one a season, pretty much. It's not that we're bitter or anything.
So there you go. A 5-minute raccoon fight, all of the powers.
Yeah, and that was interesting. To watch, you know, it's because it services the character. And you wouldn't think like the little baby, you know, would be that developed a character, but she is. And it was really fun to watch Mr. Incredible, who was kind of the main hero driving all the action portions. It was interesting to see that flip.
Yeah.
That Elastigirl is sort of the one driving all the action, is involved in like the superhero stuff while Mr. Incredible is at home. And the relief to me was it didn't make Bob, who's Mr. Incredible's alter ego, it didn't make him the sad sack and all this. It was like, oh, I can't believe I'm stuck here while my wife gets to do cool stuff.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. There's a scene where he's been, you know, he's at home with the kids and he's had a really bad day and he can't sleep. And so instead, you know, he's kind of bitter. He's a little bit bitter, and you can sense that. But what he does is he gets up and he goes down to the kitchen table and he starts learning the new math.
New math. Why would you change math? Math is math.
That's you know what? The funny part is, though, I remember hearing that from my father.
Yeah.
Learning math in school. It's like, no, that's not the way we were taught how to do this. You do this new way. And of course, that was it. It's like, why would you change how you do math? And I mean, so I mean, that's the real treat of this is how things can sound very, very true and can resonate, even though it's this big, colorful superhero movie with big action sequences and big characters.
Yeah, I would say for sure all of the home, the family stuff was really nicely done. Like, you definitely felt like they were a family, that they cared about each other. It wasn't just about the superhero stuff,
right?
For sure. And even, you know, you even got to know that, like, Frozone, you know, he's part of that. Like, all of the other, all of the other characters are still part of the family, and the parenting and the bringing it all up together. Even the police officer, right? Like, I kind of like the fact that it was, even though it's just this weird superhero family, and these people are like the other superhero and the police officer,
right? And the government people,
but that they are still like aunts and uncles to these kids,
And Edna Mode, and who makes a great reappearance, It's strange how Brad Bird seems to be able to do so easily, but you know, with a made up universe of characters that has escaped a lot of, you know, I think Honest Trailers did a thing for The Incredibles where it was like, it's the best Fantastic Four movie that's never been made. And and that's very true. And because it seems to understand the family dynamics of, you know, how they're superheroes, but also a family. But the family stuff comes before the superhero stuff.
And the
family dynamic feeds into the superhero stuff, and they bring that baggage into them whenever they're fighting bad guys.
And it's very much like it's out of time. So it's like a family story from the 60s.
Right.
So, you know, you sort of feel like Brad Bird is writing his own, like, Leave It to Beaver story or something.
With the Underminer, that's what I love about this. There's no like snide comments about, like, the Underminer has this like big, it reminds me of like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon where they where the Technodrome was in the center of the Earth for some reason, and they would come up to the surface and these drill machines. No one's like, where does he get the money for this? And it's just, that's just how the world is. You have hover trains, and you know, you have, I guess, like, kind of pre-internet, because it's kind of 60s set. It's like retro-futurism. But, you know, it's kind of never explained. It's just, this is the world. It's kind of futuristic, and it's kind of like the past, because the cars all look old. But on the other hand, you know, they have cameras that fit onto super suits. And you know, I do enjoy that. The comfort level that, you know, this is the world, to take it or leave it. We don't have to, you know, undermine it with jokey jokes and no explaining. And that is something I found, is that, like, the thematic stuff in it is very modern. Like, the stuff with the wearing the camera, like that clip we played where he's talking, like, nobody sees from your perspective. They see the damage done, and they see you in costume standing there. You know, they should be able to see. And the whole putting the camera on the super suit thing.
Yeah.
Very body camera, like with police stuff. The whole idea of perception versus reality, and the thing about the villains' whole idea is, you know, people depend on superheroes. They experience stuff through screens anymore, and they leave it up to these people who have sort of no official authority to do the things and make the world. And it's making everyone stolid and lazy. And, you know, those are, you know, the whole strongman argument is something that, you know, I've heard in places. And one of the reasons you have somebody like Donald Trump in the White House is because he came out and said, like, I can fix everything. Me personally, Donald Trump can fix everything, which is a very, you know, can be transferred very easily to the superhero ideal. And you see that in the motivation of Winston, who's that CEO character who brings him in and says, we can make superheroes great again.
Yeah.
Is that his father is killed in a home invasion after he tried to call his superhero friends for help instead of doing the smart thing, which was get in a panic room.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all these things
dinging
around.
It's the relying on other people.
Yeah. But all this is ping-ponging into this bright, colorful adventure movie. And there's so much to unpack after you've seen it. It's a great movie filled with a lot of ideas too. And I'd be interested in seeing it again to sort of unpack that further.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like, sort of as you're saying, you sort of said people become lazy and just rely. But I think it's sort of the opposite problem. It's not so much that they become lazy, it's just there's so much happening and they're so busy trying to live their life that it's just like I can't. I need someone who will just take care of me.
Yeah.
And so it's just easier than having to make the decision, like, do I go to the panic room? Do I fight back?
Yeah.
you know, or I just call whatever. Yeah. It's a weird world they live in, and that it's sort of mirroring our world.
Yeah, it's funny how the one feeds into the other. There's so many tentacles around this. There is that classic nuclear family kind mm-hmm. of thing with the Parrs. There's the whole thing about, you know, superheroes and, you know, civil rights and this kind of thing. And yeah. you have the tentacles from, you know, too much, you know, commitment on gadgets and technology. And it's
yeah,
so...
Yeah, and then just the police, really, right? Yeah. Saying, like, no, don't help.
Right.
Right? We have insurance yeah. to deal with this. We're just going to let the bad guy get away with right. it. Stop helping.
Right. There's that. I mean, that's a really powerful scene in terms of deconstructing the superhero ideal, is when they're being sort of debriefed after the Underminer is this villain in the drill tank, let's call it, who, you know, burrows holes under all these this murderer's row of banks that's just mm-hmm. lined up in downtown Malta, Munisselburg, I think is the name of the city, yes. Munisselburg. And so he gets away, and there's like probably billions of dollars worth of property damage. And they're yeah. like, okay, so all this money's gone. You didn't stop the guy, and the whole tank went on a rampage across the city. And so, yeah. you know, what did you do? And it makes you stop and think. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, maybe superheroes aren't as awesome as mm-hmm. thing. Maybe in this universe where they put the kibosh on superheroes, maybe that yeah. makes sense.
Yeah, it becomes like, does the need to do right
yeah.
outweigh the need of the majority of people to live?
Yeah.
Who knows? These are difficult right. questions. This is just a kid's movie. Come on, Brad Bird.
I know, but it's funny because when you do training in retail, and they say, like, if they're in the event that there's a robbery, you just hand over the money.
Yeah.
You remember as many details as you can, and when the robber is gone, then you call the police or you call your manager or whatever. You don't try and be a hero.
Yeah.
And or you don't refuse. Like, it's just money. It can be replaced. You can't. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's there's something about that in your. And maybe it's because we've been raised on superhero culture, but there's something in your mind mm-hmm. that's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. This person's doing wrong.
Yeah.
They need to be
punished.
Rectified.
By me.
Yeah. But but yeah. I mean it speaks to, you know, the aspirational quality of superheroes that mm-hmm. And there's even a line in like this in one point of the film where somebody says, like, who can believe in somebody who just goes out and does good for no reason at all? And mm-hmm. but that's the aspirational quality of superheroes. It's like,
yep.
You know, we've talked about Superman before and your disappointment in the direction that went in.
Yeah.
But I mean, Superman is in his bare essence very aspirational. This mm-hmm. individual who can literally do anything, but what he chooses to do is just fly around and get cats out of the tree or
yeah.
punch bank robbers. And, you know, it's usually small potato stuff, but it's what he does. It's mm-hmm. He could charge $1,000 to, you know, mm-hmm. use heat vision to put a plug in a dam somewhere, but he's not going to do that.
Yeah.
And there's also a very troubling, I guess, friction where, you know, I guess circumstances in recent years, in the last 40 years of world mm-hmm. history has taught us to look at people who appear altruistic for, you know, no reason to look at them skeptically mm-hmm. because those are the persons who end up, you know, breaking into political opponents' headquarters or getting help from foreign powers to win elections or just taking yeah. lots of money and giving it to cronies. That hasn't stopped us, though, from wanting to believe in those people yeah. either. But there's a serious friction mm-hmm. there. There are people there who look at the good guy and go, that person cannot be that good.
Yeah.
And there are people who are like, yeah, that person might have some faults, but they might mean what they say, and I'm going to give them my support too. Mm-hmm. But I mean, all this is going on in this stupid superhero movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that it's stupid, yeah. but...
I mean, it is a bit of a coming of age story too, right?
Right.
Like the two kids, and well, all three kids really
yeah.
are all, well, maybe not Dash so much. I don't know that he really had much of a character
I don't think
arc
he
from
arcs.
Beginning
yeah.
to
yeah.
end.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly Jack-Jack and Violet, right, are at places right. where they're really going through a lot of changes and trying to learn, like, who am I? What can I do? Who can I be?
Yeah.
Well, I think Dash a little bit, though, too. Like, because he was really excited about being a superhero.
Right. Well, Dash kind of gets the most painful role in sort of the climax, where he has to kind of stand by a button. It doesn't involve him, like, zipping around and trying to do stuff.
But
his powers are somewhat mitigated.
Right?
Yeah, but he still does in the end. He still does what he's being told to do. And he does feel the actual pressure of that and the possibility of failing, particularly his father in that scene, in a very serious way.
So let's talk a little bit about the animation really quickly.
Okay.
So I thought I had to watch it in 3D.
Which you hate, yeah.
I hate 3D. I can barely, like, it's just whatever. There's a lot of reasons that I hate 3D. But I did think, okay, well, at least it's animated. So
right.
3D I can handle a little bit better that way.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a part when she first went into
the
lair.
Yeah.
Right? And it was just like, until suddenly she goes into the room and all the like bright lights and suddenly it was such an animation. It was so animated.
The
I was like,
labor.
I had forgotten for a second that I was watching an animated film because it was just so nicely done and so dark and so moody that until suddenly all this like bright flashing lights started going and it was like a disco ball.
I'm not sure how conscious it was, but I did have that feeling too that Brad Bird was staging this, like he was shooting it with like on a stage with actors or on location. There is that feeling, like the way the camera moves, like there's no kind of implausible movement of the camera, like going through things or doing like these impossible pans down from like a satellite or something into an inner city or something. It's all like, it's all very consciously, this could be shot. Presumably if you had an unlimited budget, it could be shot with real actors on a real stage with real props and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised there wasn't some kind of warning about potential seizures for people.
There was a lot of strobe light effects.
Yeah, especially in that room you're talking about, because the whole room becomes like a strobe effect.
Yeah.
That when she fights this villain's called the Screen Slaver, which is almost a little too clever. That was quite out there. The thing I found with the animation, or with the movie, I should say, is that I think all the sequences were really great, but I don't think there was like sort of one great standout sequence, because we talked about Dash, and I think when I think about the first Incredibles, the thing that stands out to me is that scene where he's being chased by the drones through the jungle, and the way it's staged, and the way it's edited, and the Michael Giacchino music. It all works so beautifully together, and it's just I think it's one of the best sequences Pixar's ever done, period. And if there's sort of like one fault with The Incredibles 2, there's kind of again, not to say that any of the sequences were terrible or that a bad job was done, but there wasn't nothing sort of like that pops in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always, when I think of The Incredibles, I always think about Dash running through the jungle to that music, to the da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. That is such a great sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's, you know, it feels a bit wrong to say about a director like, hey, you didn't do that one thing,
you know,
where
this
everything
once in a
came
lifetime
together.
Thing?
Yeah.
You didn't do it again.
But having said that, Michael Giacchino music, he's been so hit and miss for me lately. He's done, like, I love his Lost music and the stuff he did for Alias. A lot of his TV work is so great, and his Star Trek themes are so great.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's done Doctor Strange lately. He did the Spider-Man movie.
Oh, yeah.
And he did Rogue One as well, but I found those scores so underwhelming. But this was so great. The going back to some of the old Incredibles theme and just like the whole 60s kick. And
yeah, I was definitely going to say, like, stay through the credits. I mean, I always stay through the credits, but through the credits we get to hear the like Frozone, Elastigirl, and Mr. Incredibles, like,
yeah, the themes.
60s Saturday morning, like, theme song type things, which were really fun.
Yeah, they were fun. I liked the music in this is like one of the real highlights. It seems to be like a real marriage of material and, I guess, an inspiration. And Giacchino seems to be like that, where even in a movie that's not so good, like Jupiter Ascending, I love his score for Jupiter Ascending. It's so much fun because you can sort of hear the movement and the action in the music. I want to talk about the short
before
The Incredibles, Boa. Yeah. Was weird.
Is it Bao?
Maybe it's Bao.
Yeah, because it's B-A-O.
Is it? Yeah, Bao. Okay. Bao. Boa, Bao. Yeah, that was weird. With the, the dumpling.
It made me a little hungry, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Because I remember I had no idea about it. I know the shorts, like the Pixar is the shorts before the main feature, but I had no idea what the shorts was gonna be. So when she makes the dumpling and she's about to eat it, and then it becomes like a baby.
Yeah,
I was just like, where is this going, Pixar?
It was very.
And then when the dumpling is trying to leave home and she eats it, and there was an audible gasp in the audience.
Yes,
and they're like, she ate the dumpling baby.
I know. It was kind of amazing actually, because it really had the impact I think that it wanted to have, because everybody was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then she was so upset. It was really nicely done.
Yeah.
I also love the fact that it was so clearly Toronto.
Yes. I was going to say that too.
They really, you know, obviously the animators must be from Toronto, because like the park.
I wondered that.
And then even when they were on the TTC too, like I've spent a lot of time, unfortunately, on those hard plastic TTC chairs with the red velour sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah. It was very nicely done. And I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I understand it, but I'm also not sure I totally understand it. Like, I get it. You know, it's just a mother missing her son who is moving out of the house, and it's time for him to move on and stop being her little baby, her little boy. But I was like, that's a weird metaphor.
It made me tear up a little because I'm close to my mom. And,
yeah.
That last scene where they're eating a, I guess, some kind of sweet that they both enjoy, and they're both sitting there trying not to cry while they're clearly bonding. But yeah, I mean, that was such a treat, because I've often found that the little shorts before the Pixar, they're a bit hard to get into. But, you know, I often found people kind of beat them up online too, like the lava one. I can't remember which one that was before, but the one about the volcano and his in the other volcano, and it's, you know, lava.
Yeah.
And I think it's called Lava, but it's that had such a catchy tune to it that it's and people seem to just hate it so much. I found myself kind of enjoying it after the fact. It's like, no, the lava thing wasn't so bad, internet. But there was also
a lot of things aren't so bad, internet.
Yeah, that's very true. The thing that triggered that was because I did want to mention the new heroes that were introduced to, because my favorite was the guy who barfed lava. So that's what kind of triggered all that.
Yeah, reflux.
Reflux, that's right. His name was Reflux.
Yeah.
And the other thing that Brad Bird gets really well is the sort of choreography of the superhero fight and how powers play it, because so often it just turns into a fist fight, and they forget that there's powers, and that's either a budget thing or a staging thing, and it's really hard to I think for live action directors to really stage that. And the only thing I could really think of and trying to think of my vast knowledge of superhero movies is the beginning of Days of Future Past, where you see all the X-Men kind of using their powers to fight the Sentinels in unison.
Yeah.
You don't really see that here, but there's this great fight between Void, who's a superhero who's been brainwashed.
Yeah.
Voiced by Sophia Bush, by the way. I recognize the voice. And, and Elastigirl, and Void can open these little portholes to play. Yeah. And it uses the power so well. And
I really liked her fight with Violet actually too.
Yeah,
because they have such unique powers, and that I did enjoy that much more than Mr. Incredible and the Crusher, or whatever they were calling him. Can you just uncrush this?
That's the part that's what made it worthwhile, because it's a fight between two big strong guys, and Mr. Incredible says, "Can you uncrush that?" And he's like, "You want me to uncrush something? What the F?" He doesn't actually say, but I mean, this, the way he's aghast. No one's ever asked him to uncrush something before.
Yeah.
But I mean, those are the little superhero details that are like so much, that are so much fun, that, you know, nobody asked me to uncrush something before. Yeah. That's stupid.
Could you unpunch someone?
Yeah. But this was a really fun movie, a really fun time, and I don't know who you saw it with, but I saw it with a fairly diverse crowd of you know, people young and old, mm-hmm. and everybody walked out happy.
Yeah, yeah. It was there was a lot of kids and parents who super enjoyed it.
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, you could hear the laughter waves through the, like, the kids who were doing things, and then the adults. And,
yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice balance.
Yep. So, well worth checking out. And that's it for the show. And if you want to check out more episodes of the show, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can go to Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter, which is just End Credits Radio. And Candace, since you are, you know, we don't know what you're going to be doing next, so you're in a bit of a void right now, speaking of the void.
Uh-huh.
So where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8. And I do hope that sometime, maybe this week or next week, there will be a new episode of the Village Podcast by the Bookshelf, but mm-hmm. don't quote me on that.
Busy beaver. Anyway, you can find me on the internet, on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.